You are listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National. Well, a very good morning and kia ora and welcome in the Auckland studio, Susie Wiles.
Good morning.
Rod Oram is there too.
Kia ora, Catherine.
And Trish Sherson.
Morena, Catherine.
And I've seen images of the punch that our producer, Glenda Wakeham, has produced. Would any of, you, like to talk us through it, or have you stayed away from it so far?
No, it's very green and gingery, and Glenda assures us it's non-alcoholic, so... It's very refreshing.
That is good. Good morning, all. Good morning in the Wellington studio to Andrew Holden.
Good morning.
No punch here, but we did give you a cup of tea and a glass of water.
Oh, and a little mince tart too. And it's great to see you in jandals with the car.
You're calling me a mince tart in jandals?
Well, that would be an interesting way to finish the year, wouldn't it? I would not be back next year. No, no, I have the coffee and the mince tart. You have the jandals on and the car packed, so that's great to see.
Yes, it's packed. It's going to be on the road at 12:01 and 30 seconds, straight into a traffic jam and a queue out of Wellington. In the Christchurch studio, Neil Jones, good morning.
Good morning.
You're away from the Beltway. Is that giving you a new perspective on life?
No, not really. I've just been hiding inside from the rain mostly.
Oh. It's no roaring nor'wester for a Christchurch Christmas.
It is a beautiful sunny morning, though, so as soon as I'm out of here, I'm going to enjoy the sun for about 2 hours before the next 7 days of rain.
Okay, I don't know who's in Christchurch at the moment. Could you get Neil a glass, either a cup of tea or a green something or anything? Good stuff. All right, well, look, let's begin, Susie Wiles, where we ought. Our science communicator is Auckland University Associate Professor Susie Wiles. She heads the Bioluminescent Superbugs Lab. The superbugs have been feeling a tad neglected because she's had other priorities this year. Susie, just I wonder if we just pick up on the news we're just hearing now about these new variants and what that's going to mean. I mean, we know our public health officials and our politicians desperately need a holiday like the rest of the country, but do we have to be thinking right now about some of the, whether we're doing some pre-testing on arrivals from the UK? What do we have to think about?
Well, we have to be always thinking about this virus. If Sydney tells us nothing, then, you know, the fact that we could at any stage end up in some, you know, change of alert levels is always a reality for us. The sad thing, so these new variants are arising. You know, we know that the virus changes. It mutates. This is something that all living things do. It's a kind of just something that happens by chance. But the reality is that the longer the pandemic is allowed to run riot, the more chance there is for mutations to happen. And what it looks like is that these mutations are also, or these strains are arising in people who might be chronically infected. So they end up, their bodies don't fight the virus quite like ours do. And so they end up with kind of many more mutations arising. And then basically you get these mutations in combination. And that's why they might be these more infectious strains emerging. And it will, you know, the people being chronically infected is a really rare event. But when you've got millions of people around the world infected, these rare events start happening more and more, right?
So we do hope minds are thinking. We heard Michael Baker this morning. Minds are putting their attention to whether or not we do need to do something extra at the border quite soon. Look, the good news at the end of a very bad year on this front is the arrival of those vaccines beginning to roll out. I had the great honour of talking to Dr. Anthony Fauci last Friday, I think it was, or Thursday afternoon. And the good news so far, touch wood, is that there's no issue yet around whether the mutations might have any impact on the vaccine. That's not been, there's been no sign of that so far.
Yeah, and that's because the mutations are in particular parts of the spike protein, which is what the vaccine is geared towards, but we tend to give the whole spike protein, and so that means we make antibodies to more than just that one region. So they should still work. But yeah, it's been an extraordinary year for just how that has progressed. But we also have the issue of many people who won't take it. And we still don't know, you know, how effective it will be at stopping transmission. We don't know how many people need to be vaccinated in order to protect via herd immunity. So there's having a vaccine is no reason to not stop community transmission of this virus.
Yeah. Look, out of all the misery of this year, and for many people, it's been nothing short of misery, especially all the separations and the business pressures and everything else for those who've lost loved ones. You've got to also reflect on the extraordinary contribution that public health and public science research has made to attacking a pandemic in a way that's probably never happened like this before in history. The speed with which a vaccine has been produced, for example.
Yeah, and I guess it shows that we can solve problems when we put our mind to it, right? That we can do things much faster than we've done in the past, because the process of doing research, you know, takes years and years of applying for funding. You know, every bit of the process has been shortened to the bare minimum. And it just shows what progress you can make in a year when funds are available and people switch their attention to things. So it just makes you wonder what we could achieve in the future if we had the same attitude for really quite a lot less bang for, or a lot less bucks than many countries around the world spend on other things like missiles and, you know, stuff like that.
Global cooperation as well, Rod. It's an interesting one. If I bring Rod Oram in now, we might talk about the business impacts of this, although I want to mention Brexit, which might be on the verge of an outcome, Rod. But if you look again at the another of your great passions, of course, which is the climate change cause, haven't we seen again what global cooperation and cooperation between the public and private sectors can achieve when you really put, you know, the foot to the pedal in an electric car way, you know?
Absolutely. And this coming year is going to be incredibly important for that as the countries of the world gear up for the Glasgow climate negotiations in the first 2 weeks of November this coming year, because that's where all countries are expected to increase their commitments. And as it stands now, countries with half the world's population in total now have net zero targets for 2050. Now, those are only targets. We've actually got to do something about that. But this is progress. And I don't want to sound as though I've enjoyed the pandemic, but it's been completely extraordinary. Wrong tense, of course. It's continuing. But it's completely upended a whole bunch of economic beliefs, which is good because economics urgently needed some reinvention. And so money is free. Well, at least for governments and central banks. And interest rates are incredibly low, as is inflation. And that made no sense in conventional economic terms. And the other thing was that the economies, as we have structured and run them, are perpetual motion machines normally. And therefore, even a recession of a couple of percentage points creates all kinds of havoc, large unemployment and the rest. But that's not happened this time. And we've really seen the very strong, absolutely irrefutable link between health first and then all else follows. So the countries that were most effective early on and continually in terms of getting on top of the pandemic have done best economically. Just a few numbers overall. The global economy is down 7% up till September this year. Here in New Zealand, it was only 2.2%. Then we could have a very strong last quarter, so our economy might be by the end of the year where it was a year ago. Government stimulus has been, all these are New Zealand dollars, 15 trillion, that is 15,000 billion dollars. Our government spent about 20 billion so far. Central banks have created $8 trillion of new money, our central bank 100 million. But global debts increased by 8%, and it's now up to about $400 trillion, and which is equal to about 3.5 times global GDP. So we've got an awful lot of navigation to do to reinvent a whole bunch of stuff. One last point as we come out of this, but one last point is, one of the things that's excited me hugely, and this isn't just about business here in New Zealand, it's about society as a whole. We've really approached the issues this year with a great deal of growing confidence and a great deal of creativity and innovation. And in business, I've seen this extraordinary change, and I hope it lasts, of a switch to iterative decision-making, making decisions based on the information you have now. This was obviously true at the height of the first lockdown, and then being prepared to morph, tack, and otherwise adjust as more information becomes available. And that's made organizations very innovative and responsive, and I hope we'll see some of that carry through into the future.
And just a quick mention on Brexit. I don't know if we're going to get it during our time today or not, but certainly there was media speculation, and this has come from, you know, sources close to talks, that they might be on the verge of a breakthrough with the trade deal. And the last I was reading is that a possible last phone call between Boris Johnson and the EU boss Andrea, whose surname's going to Van der
Leyden,
might be happening Wednesday night UK UK time, which is about now. Whether it's another false start, but how significant would that be, Rod, if they could actually crack an exit deal?
Very big, because there would have been chaos, or there will be if there isn't. This is all entirely logical, because Boris Johnson only makes decisions which are best for him, and the public support for a no deal Brexit has been falling very, very fast. Therefore, in his personal best interest is to get a deal and find a way of selling it. So we've been seeing a lot of theatre for the last 4 years, but particularly the last sort of 4 weeks or so, about how hard he's been trying and how intransigent the EU is. And this isn't never, you know, they're just not listening. They're just not being fair to us. The EU is bent over backwards to be reasonable on this. You know, maybe they're finally going to get there to
All
a deal.
Right. Well, speaking of theatre, in New Zealand politics this year, Neil Jones, Trish Sherson, let's bring you in. Neil, you go first with your bullet points. Just remind us of it, the thing that was 2020.
Oh, where do we start? So, funnily enough, we started the year with a poll from Colmar Brunton showing that National and ACT could form a government in theory. Now, I have doubts about whether that poll was accurate or whether that would have held, but it just shows how much COVID sort of threw the entire political scene on its head. So, obviously, we had the lockdown, we had Labour's polling skyrocket up to around 50% and National's plummet, and through a campaign we had basically National implode as they struggled to get to grips with Labour's newfound popularity and their lack of relevance. So we had Bridges' downfall, we had the 53-day Mueller experiment, we had the mass departures, we had Andrew Falloon and Hamish Walker.
Much of this was in July alone.
It's a very busy period.
Keep going.
We had Judith Collins finally got that National Party leadership she always wanted and then crashed out miserably to 25% in the election. And we now have an existential crisis for National. Labour has won a historic election majority. They ran a very tight campaign, focused very firmly on the COVID response, didn't do anything to scare middle New Zealand, and now face more MPs than they frankly know what to do with. We saw the ACT Party rise from being what had been written off as a sort of a one-seat party that was basically an electoral rort in Epsom that National kind of kept going out of charity, to actually being a party of 10 seats. So David Seymour had a blinder. His job over Christmas, I imagine, is to learn his MPs' names and match them to their faces. The Māori Party came back. So they were, again, they'd been pretty much written off. Labour had really not done anything to ignite the kind of anger in Māoridom that would lead to a return of the Māori Party. But I think the local campaign in Wairiki probably could have knocked on a few more doors, and the Māori Party's now got a chance to re-establish themselves. And we saw the end of New Zealand First as an electoral force, in my view, after over 25 years, through probably a range of things. The Serious Fraud Office investigation didn't help. I think Winston misplayed by going aggressive against the government rather than being the steady hand who was there at the core of the crisis. And we've seen New Zealand First exit Parliament.
It's been a year's worth in 1 month in July. And Trish, if we can just pick up one of the standouts from Neil just highlighting all that for us, is that we've ended up with the first majority government under MMP, and we've still got three smaller parties there, two of them polling really well. It's an iteration of MMP we hadn't anticipated. We thought it might have been a wipeout, and the two big parties might be how we finally got the majority government. But when you look at where things sit at the end of this year, or look back on it, what are some of the real big standout themes? I mean, this has been a year that any government would be tested by, and at the end of it all, they deserve a bit of congratulations on where things sit. Would you agree?
Oh no, I absolutely agree. You can't deny that. And even if you look at Labour just on that single issue of COVID-19, you can't deny the fact that it was really the communication and the leadership from the PM that pulled everyone together, and it was probably a very unique way that she languaged around that. So even think about how the word kindness is now in political parlance, where previously that was pretty much unknown. Also, you know, the politics that is Ardernism, I would say, is now almost a new global standard for how to do politics. And if you look at the way that other countries around the world have sort of latched on to New Zealand as an example, I think that is really interesting. The other thing that stood out to me, though, was, and this came around the election result, if you look at where Labour got to versus where National got to particularly, that was also around New Zealanders voting more on how they felt than a lot of sort of rational policy arguments. So it was a move towards positivity and really away from negativity. I think the minor parties are really interesting because, as Neil pointed out, you know, ACT had been in the ICU for many years, and the thought was life support would be turned off rather than and their life force would drain away rather than them coming off life support and actually getting 10 MPs into Parliament. The standout for me really was David Seymour, because to be a single MP in Parliament for so many years, not only is it tough and often probably a very demoralising job, but to actually pick up a couple of good issues, to really take Winston Peters on toe-to-toe and win that fight was quite extraordinary. But the Māori Party for me is the standout. To leave Parliament and be able to stay together as a political force, and really to win seats when none of the mainstream media were giving you any airtime at all, and it came as quite a surprise, I think that's extraordinary, and I think it's a good thing for New Zealand. But I think the one unsung hero here, and you picked up on the public health system with Susie, which has been amazing, but the business community also, yes, I think, is an unsung hero. So in those early days, they were one of the major voices, particularly into the government, saying shut it down. And that wasn't really well known at the time. So I think they deserve big ups there. My other big unsung heroes are actually New Zealand's farmers and the primary sector. So for many years, they've been sort of the political and environmental whipping boy. And my goodness, they really stepped up this year. And you only need to look at the pictures from Britain today of the lorry drivers who can't either get into England to bring in food or can't get out again, to remind ourselves about how lucky New Zealand is to be an incredible primary producer, because even with our borders shut, that is the one thing we didn't have to worry about, was how we're going to get our food.
You know, that's the best news story coming to Andrew Holden now talking about media. That's the best news story for me out of 2020. When things hit the fan, you can go two ways. You can fight among each other, you can try and pull things off each other, you can blame everybody, you can run everybody down, or you can all chip in and give it your best and speak your best. And right across this country, in every sector that we look at on this program, people stepped up.
They did indeed, and the media had an extraordinary year in terms of audiences. I mean, that tends to be a truism. When there's a crisis, people will turn to the trusted news sources, and we certainly saw that. We saw TV1's news hitting 750,000 people a night tuning in during winter. Stuff's website hitting a peak of 2.4 million, RNZ adding 100,000 people a year. So it was an extraordinary time for people looking for trusted information and good interrogation of it. But the media themselves, of course, were a huge story, particularly ownership. We had in April Bauer, the German magazine company, exit from New Zealand and Australia. They used Co as the excuse, but quite frankly, most people expected them to go anyway. And we've seen a whole range of independent people pick up some of the key mastheads in this country, which has been awesome. And then in May, we had that extraordinary Stuff and NZME fight, when NZME tried to bully the government and Stuff into allowing that company to buy Stuff. That all became moot at the end of May, when Sinead Boucher did a deal with Nine Entertainment Australia and bought the business for $1. And all those Stuff newspapers and the website are now New Zealand owned for the first time in many years. And the third big change in media ownership during the year was MediaWorks finally got rid of its television arm, TV3, which had been trying to do for about a year, and sold it off to Discovery. So that was a a significant event for them. The big journalistic theme, I think, of the year comes out of, as Rod was talking, around Brexit and the likes of Boris Johnson, but particularly America, and how you deal with 4 years of somebody like Donald Trump, and where does objectivity journalism come in, and should you report it? And quite frankly, that's not stopping, is it, when we see Trump in his last times throwing rocks as much as he can. And there's still that question of whether Mike Pence and the cabinet would step in and, in fact, take control before Joe Biden takes it. So there's a fascinating debate across journalism as to, going back to your question around who can you trust and what's good information, how do we deal with that when you have players who just simply are not interested in telling the truth?
Andrew, thank you. Thanks, all of you. Stay with us, please. Coming back to you for more thoughts a little later in the hour.